This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is the Washington, D.C. Poet Laureate, Dolores Kendrick. Here she is.
My brother Bob in the kitchen. I watched him in the kitchen tidying up, making metaphors of scraps of paper on the floor, leftovers, glasses needing washing, kitchen counters applying to his eyes for a little polishing. And at that moment I loved more richly the brother of him that had tidied up a life, that his of him that moved through childhood doing odd jobs after school to keep his manhood clean before it stepped upon dreams and made him sore. The party was settling in, family, all the sweet greetings, bowls and platters, potato salad, chicken, sweet and sour meatballs. Have two, he said to me, knowing the delicacy of our health. We are older now. We are aging. Each morning the light comes as a gift, I think. And I take the extra meatball because he offers it. Because he gives it, because his heart meanders sometimes to the pit of his eye and the eye of his voice, because his heart has its own seasons and has told him so, because in 68 years of shortness of breath for him is a sign of valor. In the hospital after the last attack, he fought the air around him for his dignity. They knocked him out so that the medication could do its work. When he revived, the sound of his voice quivered slowly, shook him as if he could find that fading energy in an unwashed dish or the smell of coffee or something that his kitchen could hear without his touch.
The voice of Dolores Kendrick. I'm Grace Cavalieri. What is the valor in that poem?
I think when he had a great deal of valor in that. It was not only that he had gone through a war and suffered because of that war, which was the Korean War, but his valor in his life. He was a man. He started out very young to be a man, and he had his own ethics, his own way of life, and he stuck to it very valiantly, and I respected that in him so much.
Each morning the light comes as a gift. Dolores, is that true?
Well, that's true. I think the older you get, the truer that becomes.
Yeah.
You no longer take life for granted. I remember when I was growing up, which I thought sounds like yesterday because I thought I was growing up yesterday. I used to think of my mother and my father and those people as being a separate entity. These were the old people. These were the people who were passing on until I realized one day that it was my turn, that it was my generation. And I respect every morning that comes to me because of that.
This
I think
poem,
it's a gift.
Also, it also points out, what is there to write about? Everything. And what makes this poem is the meatball.
Yeah.
I think it could have gone awry if you hadn't taken that extra meatball.
Yes.
That's what grounds the poem.
Yes, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and
really
that's what
did.
You do in your work.
Yes.
You know that everything is holy.
Right.
And you treat it that way, and then you put a meatball in it and bring us to back to earth.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes.
Let's hear another.
Young girl standing by a post killing herself. Was it the cigarette? Cigarettes kill, but so does falling weather, a late goodbye, a robin whistling on a windowsill. Her youth beguiled her, deceived her, perhaps suggested immortality, languishing in the proper mornings of her body that no sweet, long leaning could fill. She seemed to be tempting her aloneness, a magnifying magnificence of mutual agreements between herself and the killing moment. Something unguarded, frozen, still. I handed her my glance, which she refused, but looked away as she blew smoke, ghosting the glance to ashes ascending through a midday cloud. Then I thought of my little life, smoking against my will.
Mm. That's Dolores Kendrick, and she is the author of 4 collections of poems. The most recent is entitled Why the Woman is Singing on the Corner. And that is a verse narrative, a book-long narrative in poems. Her book, Women of Plums, and the Voices of Slave Women, won the Annisfield Wolf Award, and it was converted to a play. It was a musical. I believe it was at the Kennedy Center.
Yes, in two places, in Cleveland, at the at a theater in Cleveland, and also here at the Kennedy Center, we did a show.
And it won the New York New Playwrights Award.
Yes.
Wow. Mm. I've heard the music. It is unforgettable. It may still find other stages. That's what I hear.
Well, it could. Mm-hmm. We are still, you mean other performances?
Yes, I do.
Yes, that's exactly what we're working on now. The CD that you mentioned, the musical part where there are 10 poems that Wal Matthews abstracted and put into music with Alida Green, that is going to be reissued, that CD. It had gotten tremendous reviews all over the country, and it sold out and went out of print for a moment, but they are going to reissue that CD. I'm very happy about that.
Dolores Kendrick is a busy person, and we might say that about a lot of people, but when I think of you bringing poetry to corporate offices, to veterans administrations, to hospitals, to boardrooms, I tell you, Dolores, you're changing the face of what a poet laureate used to be. And so what are you doing in Washington?
Well, that's part of my program of bringing poetry to the people. I want to bring it to the people. I want to rescue it from the elitist barriers that it tends to be sort of captured in at times. I want to bring it out to the people, and going into the workplace is one way of doing it. The other way is working with the students here in Washington. My Poet Laureate Poetry Awards happen every year here, and it's been a very successful program. In fact, this year we've had our most successful program, which we did at the Duke Ellington School. All the students get awards for, and it's underwritten by the Inter-American Bank here, Felix Angel. So we get excellent awards for them and for the best poetry, and we print the poems. Also, I have a program called PIP, which is a Poets in Progress program, which are for poets that have talent but who aren't well exposed. And we do that every year in conjunction with the Folger Library. And that is, we have standing room only most of the time at that particular event. I'm very happy with that. I was a little concerned because we had gotten, it was all women there for a while, but we have two men this year who are applying for it. And it really is a wonderful event to see these talents come of age. They also have their own way of doing things, and we have alums now from that group. I'm going to read a poem called Tuning In. And I wrote this poem after I was out in Colorado, and I met a woman who loved horses. And she asked me to visit her one day out in the mountains, she and her mother. She said, "We'll have tea in the mountains and watch my horse dance." And I thought, wow. So it was very mundane. We had an old box. We put real china over the box, and we had a teapot, and we had a radio, and on she turned on Mozart. And she got on the horse, and the horse actually danced to Mozart. So I wrote this poem called Tuning In. There was the cold, the drift of autumn straining at the bit, the hardened help of new things beginning to call. "You must see my horse," she said. "Come to the field where he is. Learn him." "Oh," I would have said at another time, "see him, feel his tongue upon your hand as he takes a cookie gently, swallows it into his wide and stubborn teeth, and all the while giving you the eye, something of welcome and curiosity, something to know him by." It was Diana's horse, and her time in the field of the wind. We sat, her mother and I, below the stiff cold and earthen sky, dregs of sun sipping clouds to fleshy reeds and grass, leading to a space where Sienna stood, Diana astride, both breathing the long way in one body, spirits migrating back and forth like the creatures of the air. Let's have tea, her mother said, spreading cloth napkins over a wooden box for a table, china cups to soften our reach, and heavy blankets to keep us warm on the windswept hill, answering Diana's trot, held in the muscle of Diana's skin. In the distance, the mountains watching. The tea was hot, strong and crisp, whispering us calm contentment. Diana's mother turned on the portable radio, and we watched Sienna dance to Mozart, his steps those of the woman who had given her legs to his, the two of them in tune with the music, the sun, the field, the cold, the air and mountains, the tea, the sniff of rhythms finite before stretching space. They, horse and woman, in apogee, dancing within some high ground, some universe beyond the ordinary that shadows and stuns, they in God, dancing on air without a net.
Dolores Kendrick, we're at the Library of Congress. She's been noted as one of the top 10 African-American poets writing today. And of her, they say, Dolores Kendrick has arrived at that point in her career where she understands exquisitely what she wants to say to you. That was none other than Gwendolyn Brooks with that comment. You've done a lot to keep Gwendolyn alive. And what is your interest in her?
Well, it was her interest in me some years back when we met. And that was in the 60s when I met her in Chicago. And we have had become friends ever since that point. When I was teaching at Exeter, I made it a point that to bring her there almost every other year so that the different levels of students would be exposed to her work. But nevertheless, she had me out in Chicago. We reciprocated each other. When she was poet laureate here in Washington, she had started these Noontime readings, and she had me at those Noontime readings. She was always there for me with my work. I could always send her my work and get a response from her. And we became very, very close friends. Sometimes we just call each other and talk about the chocolate cake that I had sent her because she loved chocolate cake and things like that.
Here's something funny. People think, oh, Gwendolyn Brooks is in every book. She's on every website. She's established. She's world famous. Why do we need to do any more? That's not really the truth.
I don't think that's the truth. Mm-hmm. No, I don't. I go into bookstores today purposefully. I was up in New Hampshire recently, in Concord, visiting a friend, and we went into a bookstore because she said, I want to find out if they have your book. Well, of course they didn't. They just had the books of the poets within that area. But I looked for Gwendolyn Brooks. She's a national poet. She wasn't there. And I have gone into bookstores. I can understand why they may not have Dolores Kendrick, but I find it very difficult to find and know that they do not carry Gwen's work.
First Black Poet Laureate. Pulitzer also. First Black writer to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Right. And the first Black woman to be a poetry consultant here at the Library of Congress.
Well, this is something that people need to know.
Yes.
Because it takes a poet in existence to be an activist at every moment. In other words, you are an activist.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was the recent written work you did about her that was a scholarly piece?
They were doing a work on, there was a book out on one of her novels. And they, meaning the University of Chicago State University, and they asked a number of us who were familiar with Gwen and who were close friends to do essays on that particular novel. And so I did. I did an essay in which I dealt with the language and how she was able to use language so beautifully and eloquently. I think the title of the essay was The Eloquence in the Language of Gwendolyn Brooks in this particular novel.
Should be published in its own right.
Oh, thank you. No,
Perhaps it can be.
It was published in this anthology that the Chicago State put out. But that was a wonderful experience for me because I had to look into her bios more efficiently than I had ever done.
And I know you were huddled.
I learned a lot about her.
Yeah. Huddled down here at the library.
Yes, down in the scholars division, yes.
Working away after day.
Yes, it was quite a thing.
And we are at the Library of Congress again with Dolores Kendrick, and so we're going to go on with your own work.
Okay, this poem is called Pieta Negra and is a poem I wrote after the sculpture of Richmond Barthe, a black woman holding her lynched son in her lap. Now, this business of lynching has come to the surface again, thank God, and somehow the country is reaching an atonement for it. And I wrote this poem back in 1984, so I'd like to read that, called Pieta Negra. Her face is like a hair of noon, which glistens black back into limbs of dreams and bones of her smile, which asks no questions, which is no lie to I, the cold and stingy manger where swaddle lies her shivering child in stiff and steely jaws, claws of his jail cell hovering, which shut like headaches, streets and cities into the body of her brow. For now the comely kings will walk bearing hungry gifts of death and life and absolution one of a time, the crime of her sweet son, the will to be. What she looks upon she anoints, and yet to let the mother of her gaze die too is much a murder as her deepened dead will, more precise than laws, because she dies alone as he sinks into her lover's lap.
And that is, tell everyone what the Pietà is, the original.
Well, the original Pietà was the Blessed Virgin holding Christ as he was brought down from the cross.
Exactly. Dolores, you are known for something which is pretty rare in poetry. You are a poet now of public art. I can name two others. Richard Wilbur did a piece, a cantata, on the Statue of Liberty, and Rita Dove did a piece on the woman at the dome of the Capitol. Some of your work now is adorning some world-known pieces of art. What are they?
Right, and I think the thing that makes me extraordinarily happy about it is some commissions will ask you to write about a situation, and the poem is separate from the event itself. But in these instances, there were sculptors. The one downtown is Albert Paley's sculpture, and I was asked to collaborate with him on a poem to go into his sculpture. So the poem is written into his sculpture. And down at the, there's a metro stop, the Red Line, where I worked with Barbara Grigurtis. And in both cases, these sculptures are about 25 feet high. And I wrote a poem for the sculpture itself, which is embedded in the sculpture.
That must feel great.
It's so good. And then inside, there's a second poem of mine, which is written in aluminum along the walls of the Metro Center, at the Metro Station. So I'm very, very happy about that, because these things will be there long after I'm gone. You know.
What kind of art is public art?
You know, I think public art, the term explains itself. It's art that is designed to help the public to appreciate art as we know it. And that could be anything. It could be a painting. It could be sculpture. It tends to manifest itself in sculptures and sometimes photography.
But to write a poem about it then is a very daunting thing, because you don't want to trivialize just because it's going to be a populist piece of work. And so does that get into your gray cells and start thinking, oh, no, I have to make this poem very mainstream. I have to make it very accessible. How does that affect the poet?
Well, you know, I think, and you may know something about this being a writer yourself, it's a strange process writing a poem. There are about three or four things that are running through your brain at the same time, and it's up to you to digest them and find out how they're going to work. But they're hitting you. They're all hitting you at the same time. And in doing a poem for a sculpture, I have to think of, well, talk with the sculptor. What is his vision? Mm. What is my vision? And how can we help those visions to meet? And in between is the public art message.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful explanation of that.
Yes, thank you.
And did that happen?
It happened. It happened in both cases. It was delightful to work with these artists who are very, very extraordinary sculptors. And we had a good association.
Dolores Kendrick, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're going to hear another poem. This is a new manuscript.
Yes, the poems that I was just reading from is a new, well, it's not necessarily a new manuscript. They're new poems that I have collected, and they may or may not go into my new book.
Do you have a title?
Yes, Settle You.
Settle You.
Settle You.
Your titles are fascinating.
Well, that one fascinated me. I was in a bank one day, and I was waiting to be waited on by one of the assistants, and she had a computer, and on the computer she had pasted one of those little patch paste papers, Settle You, and she had the quote from Peter in the Bible. It comes out of Peter. And it struck me right away, and I just wrote it down very quickly and checked it out, and it comes from Scripture. So I thought, I'm going to use that somewhere.
I love
and
it.
I'm going to use that too as my new book of poetry. I had thought of doing selected poems, but for some reason I was not comfortable with it. I thought everybody, at one point a poet is going to do selected or collected poems. There's no imagination vision that I was interested in that. I wanted to do something else. And these poems will be a book of poems in which I will explain, first of all, why the poem came into being, how it came into being, and then the poem will be quoted.
There will be a little essay?
Yes, there will be a little paragraph there telling the reader how the poem came into being. And
what gave you that idea?
A friend. He was at the University of Maryland, former professor at the University of Maryland, and he suggested that to me. He said, why didn't you do that? Nobody's ever done that before. And I was very fascinated with the idea, so that's what I'm going to do.
Here's another poem.
This one is called The Cleaning Woman, Hattie Elder. Now, this poem I read at the Kennedy Center for the Mayor's Art Awards last January. And I read it with Wal Matthews, who came in from Baltimore and did the music. So we did it with a musical background.
Oh.
It went over so big, not only at the event itself, but with people who had heard it, that I was able to get it done as a broadside when I went to the University of Arizona to read recently. And it's about something that a lot of people are connected with, because not only were the people out at the University of Arizona interested in it, but also at the Kennedy Center, I got calls about it. But also, I read it at the Veterans Administration, and there were a number of people who came up to me and said, Dolores, my mother was one of those people. She put me through school doing that. And I've been fascinated by those women, because when I was here in Washington, D.C., I grew up here, and I used to travel at night. It was quite comfortable to do that, going to friends' houses to study and whatnot. And I used to see these women at bus stops at midnight or so, going into these buildings to clean them. And I thought, man, that is really some kind of a job. But nobody realized that they had a life. And I decided, well, I'm going to write about one and show us that she really had a life. And this is called The Cleaning Woman, Hattie Elder. If you held her, her bones would crack and sink into their skulls like morning frost. You would not know that her body had scrubbed its way into the flesh of the dreams of her husband and children and grandchildren with every swing of the mop or fall of floor that held the footprints of executive suites in cold, bleeding buildings, or that once she made peace with little impudent dreams that called to her in a language she surely felt, but never completely understood or wanted to know. As she was conflicted and given to odd things, old things, things that predestined her to that of caretaker. But if you dared to touch her, woman of so many years of benign love, the living of which comforted her in pale and impossible moments, you would know her bones and now gnarled hands carried within them a rich and profound blessing that was even too heavy for her to bear. So she was thankful for the skin of her dreams thinning as the days went by. She was thankful. And if you dared to touch her, you would know what she meant as she searched your face like the road leading to her tiny house, the bone and home of it in whatever traveled in your eye. Her tidy floors were her floors. No one else could clean them as well as she, and whoever walked upon them had been blessed by her. She took pride in that, and a certain care that outlasted the pain she felt in her legs and arms and back, and the wheelchair she knew awaited her for her trouble. Sometimes the buildings talked to her, and she talked back, while riding the midnight bus to home, and what there awaited. And you would know, if you dared to touch her, that her presence was what counted, even as her fragile figure beckoned you into a shelter of whatever is permanent, for touching her would expose your mortality. But if you were fortunate, she would direct your eye to a black and golden butterfly, the monarch of the lens of all your fallible senses, and you would see her enter into its wings for a midnight nap, while the executive suites smoldered, brightened, and beckoned in the dark.
Impudent dreams, Dolores? Yes. Did she have impudent dreams?
Impudent dreams, yes. That's a word I borrowed from Gwendolyn. She told me once that I had a certain impudence of language in my poetry. And I love this expression. I mean, it's exciting. It challenges me.
It sure is. Yeah. It's incorrigible. Yeah. And that's what we have to be, is a little bit wild.
We do.
To keep it fresh.
To keep it fresh.
And you did breathe life into an anonymous figure,
yes,
which you are known to do,
whether it's
a historical person,
yeah,
someone, an anonymous person through history, a woman on the street corner, or a well-known, you are known to rescue women, yeah, from obscurity.
Thank you. That's where I think I'm going, and have been, yes.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Dolores Kendrick, who is the Poet Laureate of Washington, D.C. I'm Grace Cavalieri.